everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.com. Movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm very excited for this week's show. It's Oscar week, the week where Hollywood S's its own D. And so we're going to talk about one of our favorite Hollywood movies, 1992's The Player. I am joined by the biggest player I know, JB.
I sure hope that this podcast has a happy ending, because if it doesn't, I really have no interest in listening to it.
It will. It will. Hopefully by now you guys know all about F This Movie Fest, March 9th. It's taking place celebrating the movies of 1986. We start at 10 a.m. Central. We're watching six movies from 1986. Go to fthismovie.com and read all about how to take part in the world's only all-Twitter film festival.
We're getting real excited about it in the JB house.
Good. That's good. And the whole week running up, we're going to do a whole bunch of 1986
That was
stuff.
My first full year of teaching, because
wow.
I'm old.
We're rolling it back to 1986 prices on the website.
Yes. I so desperately don't want to sound like Grandpa. Movies used to be a lot cheaper.
Yeah.
And obviously, I'm not familiar with the business end of the enterprise, but, you know, we have those fancy recliners now, and it seems like they jack the prices way up if you're just off the street. You know, I have the A-list for AMC, so it's...
As do I, and I still don't even get to use it as much as I wanted, but when we went to see Glass, we saw it in the IMAX at night, so it's going to be more expensive, and I think just my ticket for Glass covered that month's A-list. I mean, it was a $20 ticket.
It almost
to
seems...
To see Glass.
It almost seems as if the business model for the A-list is predicated on the number of times the average American goes to the movies, yeah. In which case AMC makes out like a bandit.
Oh, for sure.
But like you said, I think if I go twice a month,
oh yeah, you're
coming out. I'm in the black.
Yeah, I have to go more than that because we tend to go to matinees because that's when it's easiest to get babysitting, and those are only like $6. So I got to go see three of those to make my money back. And I'm having a hard time finding three movies I want to see.
As am I. But again, I keep reminding myself when we're recording this, it's near the end of February. And January and February is a dumping ground because people are still catching up with the award season movies. And because we tend to see stuff we're excited about right away every year. January and February is, let's use the word, fallow.
Speaking of movies that are out now, Jay Bones, have you seen anything good lately?
Yes. In fact, all three of these were stupendous, and I'd recommend all three of them. You had seen Anna and the Apocalypse weeks and weeks ago.
Yes.
Now, this is because you received a screener, I'm hoping.
Yes.
Okay. Because Jan and I kept checking all of the different streams we have for when, given that that was playing at the Music Box like in November and December, why did they wait so long? Or is it just the 2 month window or something? Like, we were memorizing the date where we can finally watch it.
Yeah.
And we finally did watch it a couple nights ago. That movie is so much fun.
Yeah.
That movie, I know Heather is a big fan of Anna and the Apocalypse. You know what it reminded me? Your daughter is a fan of Disney movies.
She is.
Specifically ones where people sing, like zombies.
Yeah,
and
contemporary Disney Channel movies. We're not talking about like actual Disney movies.
Disney Channel movies. What's the one where all the villains have
kids? Descendants.
The Descendants.
She likes Descendants too.
I have seen that
at
my house at her insistence, and I've actually seen Zombies a couple times, and Zombies ain't bad for what it is.
No, the aesthetic is garbage, and it's stylized in that way where you're just like, ugh,
but
it means well, and the songs are decent.
Right, and like you said, it means well. If any child watches Zombies and makes the jump, I'm all for it.
Yeah. No, I showed her The Beyond immediately after. Fewer songs, better kills.
So I thought Anne and the Apocalypse was like a Disney Channel musical with more swears and more kills.
Yeah.
Because that film certainly has its heart in the right place. And the Apocalypse is terrific, and it's now on demand and streaming and stuff.
Buy it on iTunes for like $10, which...
I love it when you occasionally slip me the tip.
Yeah.
Which is how I got Paper House.
Yeah.
Digitally, yeah. In HD. So I saw Anne and the Apocalypse. It's terrific. Certainly anyone who listens to this podcast should watch it. And then this afternoon, I finally sat down and watched All the Colors of the Dark.
Okay, I still haven't watched it. I watched the documentary, but I haven't watched All the Colors of the Dark yet.
Okay, last week in my column, I talked about All the Colors of Giallo. Some of the interviews for which on the documentary are from other Severin releases. Because I remember I was watching the documentary, and there was a Argento bit, and I recognized what was behind him. I recognized the background.
Okay.
And that interview is one of the supplements on whatever the film is. So it's sort of pieced together. And here I will make my admission to our loyal readers and followers. I Googled All the Colors of Giallo,
mm-hmm.
the compendium disc, the documentary. And then I chose the pictures that accompany that article.
Mm-hmm.
Today, watching All the Colors of the Dark, I think every single one of the pictures I picked, because I figured, this has got to be in the compendium somewhere.
Right.
Google didn't quite know what All the Colors of Giallo is because it's new,
and
said, oh, we know what you must mean. So if any of you...
Well, because everywhere it was written about, the two were written about together.
Because they were sort of released together.
Right.
So specifically, a casual listener... who I'm sure knows a lot more about Giallo than I do, you must have been sitting there clucking your tongue and saying, oh, JB, what a naive Jejun mistake to make. All the Colors of the Dark I was interested in because that's what Tim...
Lucas?
That's what Tim Lucas named his Mario Bava book, even though Mario Bava didn't make All the Colors of the Dark and had nothing to do with All the Colors of the Dark. This
Makes
friend
sense.
Of his named Alan Upchurch said, this is the title for the book. So yeah, you could name a book whatever you want. It's real good. I know my fallback on Giallo is the first 10 minutes are terrific and the last 10 minutes are terrific. This one's a little different.
Okay.
And I won't spoil a thing. The first 10 minutes are fucking nuts. It starts with some of the most disturbing imagery I've ever seen in a Giallo. And then they seemingly paint themselves into a corner because you can play is this a dream or is this reality for a really long time, but eventually you have to turn your cards over. And I was sitting there saying, they're not going to be able to turn their cards over. They've painted themselves into a corner. And then they don't. The denouement, though, is incredibly unsatisfying.
Oh, okay.
And I give them credit. They didn't, you know...
Well, the screenwriter, and I don't remember his name in the documentary, has all those rules.
Yes.
For what a
which is
Giallo
one of the things
is.
I like best in the documentary.
I thought that was interesting.
Every time the screenwriters are interviewed,
you have to play fair.
They talked about the structure.
Right. If you don't play fair, it's just a thriller.
Did you like the documentary?
I liked it. I feel like my memory is that I like the one on the Tenebrae disc better, which is called Yellow Fever, The Rise and Fall of the Giallo.
And I have Tenebrae, but I'm not sure if I've ever watched that.
I remember really liking that documentary, but maybe I'm remembering it wrong.
But the Tenebrae disc is Arrow, right?
Correct.
Okay.
No, just kidding. Synapse.
Okay, because now we have all these different companies who are cannibalizing each other.
Right.
I would really recommend All the Colors of the Dark, if only for Edwige Fenech, who is, I don't want to come across as frighteningly sexist, but it's pretty much the same way I feel about Barbara Steele, that you don't need a plot,
right?
Editing. Just sitter in a chair. I mean, it's my blind spot as a critic, but oh my God, she's just, you're like, how does a person like that exist for real? In any case, it's really good and has a lot of really scary moments, because in the supplementary features, someone says, well, it's not really a giallo because it's trying to be a psychological horror film more than a violent whodunit. And the other thing was, in the supplementary material, several people bring up that giallo becomes very, very popular with Argento and everyone falls all over themselves copying it. But then they brought up Italian westerns where Sergio Leone hits and then we get hundreds of sort of lookalikes, and that the film they kept comparing All the Colors of the Dark to, which didn't occur to me until I watched the supplements, was it's Martino's version of Rosemary's Baby.
Okay.
And once someone suggests that, you're like, oh, yeah. But completely different sensibility and completely different ending.
We have a giant stack of giallo movies that we're planning to watch that's in there. But yeah, there's a bunch. And
well worth it.
Erica just fell in love with Barbara Boucher, so any that she's in are going to be at the
top
of the stack.
She had commented on my column, and we went back and forth. Barbara Boucher, and we defended Barbara Boucher.
You don't have to choose.
No. No, I think you'll like it. It's also of a nice length.
I like that.
It did not wear out its welcome.
Yeah, right.
And finally, I actually got myself to the music box under the onus of a dinner and a movie, and I saw the new film by Paul Pawlikowski, Cold War.
Director of Polish Ida?
Yes, which I had a feeling would come up. Imagine Polish Ida as a musical.
Okay.
I liked it just as much. I was a really big fan of Ida, and I liked this one. If anything, this new film is much more ambitious, and that it tells a much bigger story over a lot longer span of time about these two musicians who are involved in post-war Russia, or maybe it's Poland, and the next 20 years of their lives and how their lives intersect. And there's terrific music and a lot of stuff that you'll like if you liked Ida. It's in black and white as well.
I'm sorry, what movie?
Cold War.
No, if I liked what movie?
Ida.
I'm not familiar with.
Okay, that would be Polish Ida.
Thank you.
Which, not that we care about those things at F This Movie, which won the Academy Award for Best Foreign Film the year it came out, because that was Music Box Films,
right,
the releasing arm of the company who owns the theater that we talk about constantly, that's the happiest place on earth.
I read an article today about A Star Is Born, and it referenced Cold War in a way that made me think I might not be able to see it right now. But I can ask you about it. Off mic.
I think I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And we'll talk afterwards.
Okay. That's a movie that I was going to catch up with before the Oscars, but I read Birth, Movies, Death is predicting Green Book to win Best Picture. What is the world?
Again,
if Rami Malek is going to win Best Actor.
I don't.
What is the world?
I don't mean to set myself above anyone. I'm the lowest of the low. But I'm a sucker for sentimentality. Ask my wife. Green Book is bad for a number of reasons. And Viggo Mortensen, who I'm a fan of, it's an embarrassing performance if you're Italian-American. And I am. So finally, I'm not weighing in on Peter Sellers playing Charlie Chan.
Right.
I'm talking about Viggo Mortensen playing one of my uncles. And it's well-intentioned, which I'm assuming is why it's getting all these nominations and awards. I want people to live together in brotherhood, too. But the situation that the film itself sets up, if Viggo Mortensen is truly the man in the first 10 minutes of that film, the doctor's piano playing is not going to change his mind about his personal preferences. It's just not. So I think I needed more. And this is, we've talked about this before. Some things in movies are easy. Other things are really hard.
Yeah.
And it would be really hard to show his opinion of the doctor changing incrementally.
Right.
Based on a series of things.
Right.
Not just, boy, he plays the piano swell.
You know my feelings on the Oscars.
I'll reward him by teaching him how to eat fried chicken.
Oh, God. You know my feelings on the Oscars, so I have no real stake in any of this. But I have a feeling, if the predictions are right, this may be the worst Oscars in recent memory, in terms of what wins.
And by that, you might mean best, because here's how I'm looking at it. The minute you said that, because I haven't been following any of the prognostication. If Green Book wins Best Picture, I will be just a little bit more off the hook about liking Crash.
That is true.
Because everything's relative.
That is true.
And at this point, I would point to The Greatest Show on Earth, which is my usual go-to. Yeah. That won Best Picture, too. It's a movie about a circus.
So did The Artist. I mean, we could go on and on about the movies that you say, really? That won Best Picture?
And The Artist is made for me.
Yeah.
It bends over backwards.
Right.
To...
P.S. The Artist is fine. Like, it's fine. It's fine. I forgot it the second it was over. It's fine.
The best thing I can think of to say about The Artist is
it's fine.
It's a trifle.
Well, right.
It's...
But again, Hollywood has
it's inoffensive.
S its own D, which we'll talk about some more.
There's one scene in The Artist, though, I can't get out of my head. When the actor, when the lead actor.
Jean Dujardin?
Yes.
Teaches, best actor?
When
won best actor.
When he teaches, the scene in The Artist, when he teaches the little dog how to
eat
fried
chicken.
Yeah, beat me to it. That was the stuff.
Yeah.
That if there was still a great movie ride at Disney, which of course there isn't. They would redo the ride just to add teaching the dog to eat fried chicken.
For sure, except the actors would look very scary. Gene Kelly would look like TV's Joker.
Oh, no.
It was a nightmare version of Gene Kelly.
I don't mean an audio animatronic. That's far too expensive.
Oh, got it.
They're not going to refurbish those. They just kept playing. They would say, we're going to give this a sheen. And then it would reopen. And the only thing they changed was the clip show at the end.
Oh, I like it. Yeah.
And once they changed the narrator, they added Robert.
Robert Osborne.
They added Robert Osborne like a month before he passed away. It was a bad omen.
Well, he's a ghost. What have I seen? I saw a movie called Braid. It's Women in Horror Month, and I was trying to watch a female-directed horror film. It's out on VOD now and in limited release, and it's directed by, written and directed by Mitzi Perone. It's about two girls who are sort of low-level drug dealers on the run from the cops. They go find their childhood friend living in this mansion by herself. And they're going to rob her, but first they have to play all these weird, twisted games with her. And the friend is played by Madeline Brewer, who some people might know from Handmaid's Tale or Cam, which was a horror movie that got a lot of attention last year. It's a frustrating movie in that you watch it and you're like, boy, this is a director who really is doing something, but without maybe a whole lot to say, and the style begins to overtake the movie at a certain point. So you're kind of watching a style reel instead of a narrative. So it's like a well-directed movie that did nothing for me. And it was a movie that made me say, oh, I would see what this person makes next, but I'm not crazy about Braid.
Every year I'm the judge at a student film festival. So I know exactly what you're talking about, where I have too many ideas. Well, let's sit you down and find the ideas that go with this content.
Right.
But I have so many ideas. So the film becomes ideas because, again, most student films, most short films err on the side of not having enough.
Sure.
A lot of them are sort of one-joke things.
Yeah.
The opposite, of course, is I have this feature-length screenplay that I'm going to cram into 10 minutes. But that's more rare that student films don't have enough there.
I wonder if this was based on a short.
Aha.
I don't know that it was, but it seems like it might make for kind of a cool short. We saw Made for Each Other for the first time, 1939, Jimmy Stewart and Carol Lombard.
Oh, yeah.
We've been, you know, just recording all this stuff off of Turner Classic Movies. And on the weekend, we'll watch one or two. And I came to the realization that as much as I like Jimmy Stewart, this was an early Jimmy Stewart starring role, as much as I like Carol Lombard, I don't like melodrama. Every time we've watched one of these melodramas, I am just not a fan. And it was very popular during this time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And man, none of them do anything for me. So when we're watching comedy, because we also watched Melvin Douglas, Burgess Meredith, That Uncertain Feeling.
Right.
And it's really fun. It's really good. Melodrama, man. I have no patience
for it.
This
is one of the great ironies of TCM specifically, that the movies that were really popular and prestigious back then do not age well.
Yeah.
And the movies that, for lack of a better term, got shit on, the comedies and the horror films, you watch them and it's like fresh as a daisy.
Yeah, yeah.
This week, there's been the Twitter, here's something to get you upset du jour, has been some guy who published a couple little snippets of John Wayne's 1971 Playboy interview.
Okay.
Guess what? He had some pretty retrograde opinions about a lot of things.
What?
In fact, the person
Not the John Wayne I know. Not the John Wayne who hated High Noon.
I've got this bootleg of celebrities being taped when they're not taped, and it's that Orson Welles thing.
Yeah.
Where he's the
and William Shatner, right?
Oh, it's got all that.
I say sabotage.
And there's a thing where he's speaking at a dinner, like he's the after dinner speaker, and he's drunk.
Oh, good.
And he coins the term re goddamn ridiculous.
Oh yeah. It's getting to be re goddamn ridiculous.
I mean, would you think those boys at the college would take those protesters and clean it up?
Yeah.
Anyway.
Anyone who uses the phrase un-American as much as John Wayne did.
This is the longest setup for a very simple joke. Today, our very own Eric Asperschlager tweeted, please tell me Jimmy Stewart didn't do a Playboy interview.
Jimmy Stewart was super conservative, though.
Right.
Old school conservative,
but
same as modern conservative, but he was very conservative.
Jimmy Stewart and Clark Gable fought in World War II
in
positions that were very, very dangerous.
Yes.
The Duke sat out the war.
Sure.
Which I've read in more than one book, John Ford mercilessly derided him for his entire career. Apparently, Ford was very fond of putting John Wayne in his place.
Wow. Interesting.
Just imagine what those sets were like.
They both sat around and complained about High Noon?
It was like a testosterone contest.
God. Jimmy Stewart and Henry Fonda once got in a fist fight over politics because Henry Fonda was super liberal.
Which, again, strikes me as odd because I've read some things about what kind of a husband and father he was.
Henry Fonda?
Yes. Sure. And, again, no one's perfect, but it's... You shouldn't read anything about anyone's personal life. That's the simplest thing. It makes me very happy that you're watching and taping things off TCM. The other night, with my little Apple TV, I discovered that there's a TCM app. In fact, I think it's one of the reasons why...
Is it new? Because I've looked for it before.
It's on my Apple TV,
okay.
And I'm not really tech-savvy anymore.
Okay.
It passed me by. But... I think it's one of the reasons why Filmstruck, why they decided to close that, because whatever corporate entity behind the TCM part of Filmstruck was saying, we're offering this
right.
for free.
Right.
We'd rather that you subscribe to cable. So here's the deal. You download the app onto your Apple TV. I'm assuming there's a similar one for Roku. The process for getting it up and running is a little complicated because you have to prove to the app that you have a cable subscription.
Yeah, I've done that before.
But it's one of those things where something texts you something to
it's
your
not
phone.
Hard. You just select
it's
your
like,
cable.
It's me. This is my house. Would you just let me do it?
This is like brand new on Roku. This is life-changing.
Okay, and here's...
Because I'm telling you, a few months ago, I tried and it didn't exist. You could only watch it on your laptop.
And this is the way that I watch the player in anticipation of tonight. I believe every month, everything on Turner Classic Movies is available on demand on this app.
For like 2 weeks.
And it's an embarrassment of riches. It's like, wow, talk about, it's like someone's afraid you're going to cancel cable because there's a lot of, if you get enough subscription services through a Roku or something. I think Comcast is scared because Comcast recently started offering Netflix and Amazon Prime through the cable box, figuring some people that's their only way of getting it on the good TV. The only problem is it looks like shit, which I'm thinking, is Comcast doing this on purpose?
Yeah,
so
right.
People say, I'd rather spend $3 to rent it. The other thing was we noticed this because we watched Buster Scruggs for a while through the cable box, and then we went to the Apple TV. On my cable box, Netflix lags in this. If you're at all a purist, there'll be just 1 second that's off, and then it goes back to like regular, like it stutters. So now I watch everything. Because I think at this point I'm subscribing to everything. I actually became a charter subscriber of the new Criterion channel.
Yeah.
I think I have every streaming service except Shudder.
You should get Shudder.
Well, because
Shudder's really good.
Because you've seen horror noir, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
And is it ever?
It's really good.
People
yeah.
are saying
yeah,
it is.
Yeah, it's really good.
So I think.
And the Creepshow series is going to be on there that Greg Nicotero is doing.
So I got to add this up because I think it's starting.
It's like $5 a month. It's not bad. Shudder is surprisingly cheap for what you get.
Oh, I thought it was more.
No.
If you have a cable subscription and some sort of streaming device, though, I'm not here. I'm speaking to our listeners.
Oh, got it.
the TCM app is amazing.
Just don't watch Made for Each Other because it's not great. The last movie I'll talk about is Erica and I went to see Happy Death Day to You.
Monday.
Yes. And did you see the first one?
No.
It's charming. It shouldn't work, but it does enough on the basis of the energy of the movie, and the lead performance by Jessica Roth is really funny. And the sequel sets up in the first 10 or 15 minutes something really wacky. And there's a joke in the original movie, and it's not a great joke, but one of the characters says, you know what this reminds me of? That movie Groundhog Day. And she's never heard of it. And that's kind of the joke of the movie, is that they at least call attention to the fact that all they're doing is Groundhog Day. And so this movie makes that joke much earlier, and someone says, you know, this reminds me of Back to the Future 2, because that seems to be what they're setting up with different timelines and characters interacting with themselves. And I got kind of excited that like this movie was just going to go off the rails in a crazy way and decided to be something completely different from the original. And then it kind of settles into being more or less a sideways remake of the original movie.
Because that's fascinating that you're saying it. Again, I haven't seen it, but the comments I'm seeing is that people don't like the fact that there's this twist. People don't like the fact, I have seen complaints that it's not enough like the first one.
That's a crazy complaint to have about a sequel, because
that's what made me want to see
it. They made that movie.
Because
watch
someone,
that movie.
Because someone said there's this clever turn.
I like when sequels say, okay, we did the first one. Why would we do that again? Let's make something else. And this movie does it enough. I mean, it's different enough, but I got real excited for a little bit, and it didn't quite live up to what I was hoping.
Because a lot of people go to sequels like cornflakes.
Right.
They like cornflakes.
Right.
And they want more cornflakes.
Right. Which I get to an extent, but, you know, when you go see a James Bond movie, you want it to be a James Bond movie. But anyway, let's talk about The Player.
Yes.
1992, Robert Altman, who's been on the outs for 12 years.
Yeah.
I mean, since Popeye, probably, or even before.
A lot. And this puts him back on the map, gets him out of movie jail.
Yeah.
Which I think is interesting.
Yeah.
Because the first point I wanted to bring up was, do you think, for what this movie is, which is a satire of Hollywood, that you could fault it for being too nice?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I don't think it's quite as acidic as its reputation. Everyone talks about, oh, man, Altman it's hand that feeds him. Ooh, he's fiendish. I don't think it goes that far. And it lands a lot of easy punches because Hollywood is a pretty easy target. And it's very funny to me. Again, we were talking about The Artist and we were talking about, you know, Hollywood just falling all over itself when it can give itself awards. Aren't movies magic? Here, take all the Oscars, us.
You know, it's the universal language
right.
of film.
So the player is Hollywood showing what good sports they are. See, we love it and we embrace Robert Altman, even though he's mocking us. But he's not being that harsh about it, I don't think.
Where I see a harshness is, and the player even brings this up, most Hollywood protagonists are not allowed to be too awful because the fear is I have to watch this character for 2 hours.
Right.
Griffin Mill is awful.
Sure.
And the film is not shy about showing us how awful he is. And the thing that I always point to is the first time he goes to that little cafe to have the power breakfast and he passes Burt Reynolds and Charles Chaplin. And Burt Reynolds just says as an aside, real asshole. And then Chaplin.
And that's Burt Reynolds saying
that. And Chaplin had some sort of comment. And then later in the hotel, the scene with Malcolm McDowell.
Yeah.
If you're going to badmouth me, do it to my face.
Right.
The film is full of these things that really show what a dick he is. And the only reason why we might not think he's a dick is because he's the character that we're following.
Also, counterpoint, who are the characters in the movie who are not garbage people? Except for Whoopi Goldberg.
Okay. I love the camaraderie of the police officers and the detectives.
She has so much interesting, weird business. The whole thing with the tampons.
Oh, yeah.
It's just this little color that's left in there.
But that scene makes me uncomfortable.
About. Yeah.
And you're talk about putting you in the place of Griffin Mill. I think the Cynthia Stevenson character is very, very
yeah, she ends up being kind of tragic, I guess.
Yeah,
yeah.
That she gets a lot more than she deserves.
I just think so many of the people in the movie are awful that you almost don't have a foil for Griffin Mill where it's like, oh, yeah, they're all like this. So he doesn't seem particularly bad by comparison.
There's a coolness to Fred Ward's head of security that
he's Josh Brolin in Hail Caesar, right?
Completely missed it the first time I saw the player low these many years ago, but watching it recently, he knows everything.
Yeah,
he know like he knows exactly what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really great. Contributing to your point about there being no one who's really positive,
right?
I was very taken. Watching it this time with Vincent D'Onofrio and have always liked him. So many films where he's the main attraction. I think we've spoken of the film The Breakup.
Yes.
Which I think would be better if they had dropped the main plot and the entire film was about Vince Vaughn's relationship with his brother at Three Brothers bus tours. And D'Onofrio's terrific in that. And in the Magnificent Seven remake, he's the only one trying to
He's fully become Orson Welles.
Yeah,
by that
he's
movie.
Trying to do something interesting. He's got a very entertaining Twitter feed, if any of you are interested.
Really?
But the screenwriter, I think it's David Kahane.
The character's name.
The character.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's awful.
Yeah.
He's really awful.
Everyone is terrible. That's what I'm saying.
And clearly, he has to be awful.
It's written with a poison pen.
So we think something's true that winds up not being true.
Right.
But considering that someone pretty high up in the studio has sought you out and now wants to offer you a deal, to mock and deride that person mm-hmm. it seems counterproductive in terms of your career.
Mm-hmm. There's a little bit, and I mean, I'm sure we're all guilty of this, but I think the movie is a little bit easy when it comes to old movies were good and new movies are bad. And we see it again and again, not just in Fred Ward's dialogue, in the posters that they keep ending shots on, Vincent D'Onofrio talking about the bicycle thief,
right.
And Griffin Mill is a garbage person because he only saw 5 minutes and he didn't stay and see the whole thing. He's not... He doesn't really care about, you know, good movies. It plays that card a lot of times, which I think is cheap. I understand the point that they're making about contemporary movies.
Well, I thought that was cheap until a very good friend of ours went to the film school at the Art Institute. This was several years ago and kept reporting back to me that today's film students have no interest whatsoever in our film heritage and older films. So I kind of give the film a pass. Although
in my experience, they also have no interest in current films.
Well, that's inexplicable. I'm trying to think of the word here. That there's this logical fallacy that when we look back to the past, God, movies were so great.
Even
looking 5 years ago. Because you're only remembering the good ones. When Turner Classic Movies does a 1939 retrospective, some people think that was the pinnacle of Hollywood,
right.
They're not showing the bad ones.
Right.
They're showing Gone with the Wind and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and, you know, all the really good ones. Stagecoach. Wizard of Oz. So I think the film engages in that, it's picking and choosing. Oh, they're at this little repertory screening and they're not seeing the film that you just brought up with Jimmy Stewart. They're seeing Bicycle Thieves.
Right. It also, again, goes out of its way to say everyone's garbage because even the Richard Grant character,
which I wanted to talk about next.
And he's very entertaining and it's great to see him and stuff. And he's probably about to win an Oscar if Mahershala Ali doesn't. He's a sellout, so haha, fuck him. But even before that, the scene where he's pitching Griffin, he's already insufferable and pretentious, and this is real, and that's no movie stars. You know, I mean, the whole scene is very funny.
Although the thing I like most about that scene, and this might be something that's a little bit in, and that this is probably Michael Tolkien who wrote the novel and the screenplay. Whenever he does his pitch, he starts with that scene mm-hmm. outside the prison mm-hmm. and talks about the rain and the umbrellas and the flashlights.
Lanterns, right.
And it looks like Chinese lanterns. And that is a really great way to start a pitch because you're sitting there saying, that would be visually interesting,
right.
And I've never seen that in a movie before. And he keeps doing it whenever he's called upon to describe the film. So that I actually like. The punchline of that joke is terrific. And I would even argue that the punchline...
The one about the test audience?
The whole Richard Grant subplot.
Okay.
The punchline is so great, I think the fact that the end of the player proper, spoiler alert,
yeah.
is essentially the same,
right.
down to the dialogue.
Right.
Is...
The music also?
That I'm not sure.
When I watched it today, and when the music for the credits came up, I thought, is this the music from Habeas Corpus? I already couldn't remember.
Habeas Corpus.
Yeah.
And the film is famous for its cameos.
Yeah.
It's full of cameos, especially in that it's like a dinner party outside, and mm-hmm. Griffin gives a speech, and it's like Robert Altman said, come by, have some drinks. We're going to be filming.
Right.
And... Robert Altman, I'll be there. But even the secondary stars that are in the scene when we actually see the end of Habeas Corpus.
Mm-hmm.
It's Susan Sarandon and right. Peter Falk and Ray Walston. And then, of course, I won't spoil it, but I remember seeing The Player when it first came out. I think I saw it the Friday it opened, and it was really surprising. Kind of like the surprise cameo they didn't ruin in the advertising of Zombieland. It was really surprising, maybe because I didn't have it spoiled for me, that they managed to get those two stars, especially because one of those two stars is used throughout the film
right.
as shorthand.
Right, right, right.
That every film, apparently, is going to star her.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I had some. Oh, the pitches at the beginning I wanted to talk about, because they're really. There were lines that I wanted to be writing down, and I didn't have anything with me. But Buck Henry has maybe my favorite line in the movie.
If it's the same line, it is my favorite line in the movie.
Is it when he's repeating back? It's fun.
It's different then. It's not the same.
Okay,
line.
What is yours?
Buck Henry is pitching a black comedy. And in asking questions and providing conversation, Griffin Mill is ushering him towards saying that the film is something that it's not. And Buck Henry, who no doubt has actually pitched things, is more than willing to say it's whatever Griffin wants it to be, plus what he originally...
Right.
So it's a comedy. Well, yes, it's a comedy and a romance. It's a black comedy, but it's also a romance. And he just, even then, you see this being steered away from its original.
I thought I had it for a second, but it's when he lists all the things together.
Oh yeah,
it's a comedy and a romance and a stroke. It's when he throws in and there's a stroke that. Was
because,
the funniest line in
because
the movie
my favorite line is Mrs. Robinson has had a stroke.
Just the whole The Graduate 2 is funny in 1992 and is now very much the reality that we're just going back and cannibalizing everything that
and
was
there is
once
a
great.
Film there is a film that's sort of kind of
The Graduate 2.
I believe it's called Rumor Has It. I've never seen it.
Oh, I have seen it.
It fell apart because they couldn't get If they had gotten Catherine Ross and Dustin Hoffman, it might have worked.
Is that who it was supposed to be?
Oh, yeah. Because the character in the film slowly begins to think that the graduate is based on her mother and father.
Yeah, that's sort of the plot, I think. I barely remember.
I believe it's Jennifer Aniston.
It is. And Kevin Costner.
Right. And I don't know who plays.
Some others.
But
I don't
if
remember.
You're going to play that game, I guess because... She thinks she's the real child.
Right.
You don't have, because then it's a mirror reflecting a mirror.
Yeah.
But we should point out that Mrs. Robinson has a stroke, is part of a 7-plus minute tracking shot.
Yeah.
That they did 15 times.
Yeah.
And this is where the film begins to get a little up its own ass, but I'll forgive it. The film begins with the clapstick.
Right.
And apparently we're watching take 10
right.
of the 15 takes. But it is an amazing
yeah.
shot.
Yeah.
That's just, it's like Orson Welles' Touch of Evil. Here, we'll show you how
which
this
of course
is really,
then we have to have Fred Ward talking about right on screen. I mean, the movie is definitely up its ass a little bit, you know. Not in a way that irritates me, but again, just sort of the way it folds back in on itself at the end is sort of being up its own ass, you know, which is okay. Again, to think about, and not that Robert Altman didn't make anything good in the 80s, because he had, no. you know, he made Secret Honor in the 80s, and he made Come Back to the Five and Die and Jimmy Dean. Like, he had good movies that he was making.
He did a Caine Mutiny for television, which was amazing.
Okay, I never saw that. But
I think it was broadcast live.
His stuff wasn't, you know... He was also making not Up the Academy. That's Bob
O.C.
Downey.
And Stig.
O.C. and Stigs. Thank you. Right. I mean,
which
he
the
was...
Chicago Film Society showed the other night at the Music Box.
Yeah.
35mm print.
Ooh.
The weather was shitty. I couldn't make it. But my God, I would ask Jan. I was like, when will I ever get to see O.C.
Gosh,
and Stigs
right?
in a movie theater?
I saw beyond therapy at some point in the last 6 months. And it's like unwatchable. How is this Robert Altman? One of the things that when you were talking about Tim Robbins being kind of a garbage person and somehow, you know, studios won't usually let you do that, won't let your lead be a bad person because who else are you supposed to follow? I think one of the things that the movie does so well is you still are willing to sort of track the Griffin Mill story because the mystery is actually kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And that the movie works even if you don't totally care about all the up its own ass Hollywood stuff, you still can just enjoy the movie as kind of a mystery. Who's sending this stuff to Griffin Mill and will he get away with this?
And that's an example of the film being up its own ass that works.
Right.
Because if we were just commenting that every pitch has to suggest that the film that they want to make is every genre under the sun, how many genres does the player itself encompass and do well?
Right. Yeah. I like the recurring joke in all the pitches that everything is this meets this.
Yes.
That they really are only speaking in other movie titles, which from the little bit I know of actual movie pitches very popular.
And from what I've been told, it's very.
That's how you pitch something.
Nothing exists without it being based on something else.
Yeah.
It made me think about other Hollywood satires. And we may have discussed this once or twice on the podcast, but it reminded me during this viewing of the Blake Edwards film SOB, which couldn't be different in terms of tone, but is very similar in terms of at the time SOB was released, it was seen as scathing and edgy and stuff. And that both of the plots, though very, very different, hinge for their edginess on the fact that someone dies.
Okay. I'm trying to remember SOB. I saw it maybe a year or two ago. And I mean, I know who dies in SOB, but.
And SOB is not.
I didn't love SOB.
SOB is not good because Blake Edwards, I think, was very, very talented, but needed like handlers or something. I think SOB is half a good movie.
Okay.
The other night I was watching The Great Race on Turner Classic Movies, and that's half of a good movie. But it's just so bloated and full of stuff that doesn't belong there. I think the Richard Mulligan performance is this amazing thing that they should have focused on. I think Mulligan's really, really good. And then you need 12 other characters.
Right.
So
right.
Jack Davis can draw a poster where everyone's running either to something or away from something. But in terms of does the player play too nice? The other day on... Was it Turner Classic Movies? I think it was. I rewatched MASH.
Okay.
And MASH is not nice. MASH, I think, not only does it still hold up, but the satiric points that it's making are very harsh and very in your face.
Yeah.
And it's not a cuddly film at all.
Right.
And I'm not just talking about the surgery footage, because that's the sort of the cliche, he contrasted black humor with actual realistic surgery footage. That what's going on in that film is not nice. And you have some of the trappings of the sort of standard war film where at the end they play the football game and stuff. But thinking about MASH made me think about the player and the player's ending, where suddenly this film that we've seen, which is being held up as being risible because it's been changed by the Hollywood system, is now mirrored in the ending that we get of The Player. And I began to think about how many times Altman had done stuff like that before. MASH has a recurring joke with the announcements from the PA system of what movies are showing that night and if someone has donated hymnals to the church. And then suddenly at the end, the PA system comes alive and says, you've been watching MASH tonight, and with the real actors' names. And then his next film was Brewster McCloud, where suddenly the last 10 minutes is this Fellini-esque circus thing in the Astrodome, where suddenly all the main characters in Brewster McCloud are presented as circus performers, and William Wyndham is the what do you call the guy in the top hat?
The ringmaster.
Yeah. Announcing the people in the film is so. This is not something new in the player.
Right.
Altman's very adept at sort of playing with. This is just a movie, folks.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of his movies are sort of about being movies, which is something that I don't think I realize I responded to so much. And then the more I think about who some of my favorite directors are, so many of their movies sort of call attention to the fact that, like, this is a movie, and I love making this, and I'm going to show you how much I love making this. And that's one of the things that... in Robert Altman's best movies. Bad Robert Altman movies I find pretty unwatchable.
Well, I would say that for the most part, they're the pretentious ones, like Quintet.
Or the sloppy ones. I've never seen Quintet.
It's problematic.
Yeah.
And Quintet is pretty bad. Health is hard to watch. A Wedding doesn't get the attention it deserves. If you look at the films he's made that are critical favorites, you would think The Wedding would be mentioned more because it seems to be perfect Altman. You know, it's a wedding, and there's 20 major characters and lots of overlapping dialogue.
Right. It's interesting that the player is, you know, Altman's comeback, and he could sort of, our collective memory is, after this, he did no wrong, but he had a number of middling to forgettable movies, even post The Player. Although I will say one of my favorite things about The Player is that it gave rise to Shortcuts, which is one of my absolute favorite Robert Altman movies.
It is unbelievably great.
And you can see a lot of the cast in The Player that he then calls back to star in Shortcuts. I mean, so many people.
Because Altman always loved having
this
little group.
And it was, I mean, it ended up being a pretty big group, you know, and you see a lot of them show up in cameos in The Player, a lot of his sort of stock company. He loves actors and he loves fucking around with movies. I think about The Long Goodbye and like how every song in that movie is just The Long Goodbye. Just different. He's in the grocery store and it's the Muzak version of The Long Goodbye. I mean, he's constantly just doing little things like that where he's not blatantly deconstructing movies or genre, because I wouldn't say that there's anything. He's not really deconstructing anything in The Player.
Oh, okay. I thought you meant The Long Goodbye.
No,
The Long
Goodbye
he
is. Yeah, for sure. And he does it with Westerns in McCabe and Mrs. Miller, and he kind of does it with war films in MASH. I don't think The Player is really a deconstruction of, like, the thriller.
No.
But it does, in some ways, deconstruct the movie-making process, even with the ending that we're talking about, or with that long shot at the beginning, you know. It's just a movie that's full of, like, cool shit like that and good scenes.
And the other thing I like, and this is just based on someone who's not in the film industry, but who follows the film industry and loves visiting his son in California, because everyone in California thinks they're in a movie starring themselves.
I would argue that social media has made it so that everyone... everywhere now
we can export the California dream.
Yep.
Ooh, you're so important. People want to see pictures of you that you took in a men's room mirror.
Here's constant updates of my life, fans.
So, having gone to Universal more times than I want to count, because I love Universal, and then we once took the Warner Brothers tour, which was delightful. There's something very odd when you're on a movie lot, even if it's half amusement park. But they do make movies at Warner Brothers. They actually make them there. And Universal's a working film studio. And I think what The Player captures is, this is not a real place.
Mm-hmm.
And what would it be like if you went to work, if your job was working in this not real place, which traded in dreams and fantasies and things. I just remember my friend who works for Universal in Florida loudly complaining that once the Fast and the Furious ride is finished, it will ruin the view from her office.
I find myself this morning when I was watching The Player, it was like, on the one hand, what a great job to work in movies, to have people come in and pitch you stories and decide what movies get to be made and just to be creative all the time. But the movie also makes a point of saying, oh, no, it's a terrible place to work where you're constantly sure that your days are numbered and you're going to be fired on a whim and you're going to be backstabbed and stepped over.
Of course, because how could I be so lucky as to have this,
right,
this job of jobs?
And that's, I mean, every story I've ever read, every book I've ever read that's honest about working in the business is that's the career trajectory is you get fired. Everything is temporary and you're only in a job for so long and then you get fired and you move on to somewhere else and you do that job for a little while and then you get fired. Think of every studio head, every producer, you know, I mean, it's like we do this for a little while. Even the Thomas Lennon, Ben Garant book where they talk about screenwriting.
Yeah.
It's like the first thing that's going to happen when you sell your script is you're going to be fired. And that's good because that means they're hiring different writers and investing money into making sure they say the trick is to be the first and the last writers on a draft or on a screenplay, because eventually they'll go through 20 other writers. None of them will fix the problems and they'll come back to you and you get to have the last pass on the script. And so when it comes to like arbitration, you want to be the first people who wrote it and the last people who wrote it. And it's like, what an insanely stressful, terrible way to live. But the trade-off is you get to make movies. I don't know. I couldn't do it. But
And I'm thinking about tenure right now.
Mm-hmm.
And how I was really glad I became a high school teacher. Not that in any way, shape, or form I would ever be talented enough to do anything in the movies, except perhaps be a slightly visually arresting extra, which then takes you out of the running to be an extra because they don't want
right interesting looking people.
Who's that guy in the corner?
You had mentioned you know, Hollywood satires or just movies about movies. Where does this rank? And what are some of the other really good ones?
Well, near the top, and I have to say, I was thinking about SOB and I was trying to find, is this a true subgenre? Because there aren't that many that are comedies. I can think of Singing in the Rain to a certain extent. Bad and the Beautiful fits, but it's not a comedy.
No.
It made me think about Get Shorty, which, again, has a few things in common with The Player. Specifically, what makes it edgy is that someone dies.
Right.
Because most comedies have to, at least how that's portrayed. I mean, if it's cartoonish.
Well, but, and that the movie is putting gangsters and film industry on equal footing.
Yes.
But it's doing it in a real kind of bubbly, light way, whereas The Player is a little bit darker. And it's letting you know that, hey, we know that we're being cynical. And Get Shorty doesn't tell you in the stylization that it's a cynical movie at all.
Right. Though it is.
Absolutely.
And
Get Shorty, by the way, I just showed it to my class a couple weeks ago.
Yes.
It's so fucking good.
It really is.
It's maybe my favorite. I mean, John Travolta in Blowout, I still think is his best performance, but it might be my favorite John Travolta performance.
When it first came out.
God, he's a movie star.
When it first came out, I was like, why isn't this getting more attention? Because you were saying how Fred Ward draws our attention to the fact that we're watching a seven-minute. Yeah, yeah. All of Travolta's references in Get Shorty about, because what The Player and Get Shorty understand is that people like us take movies very seriously, mm-hmm, and we have all this information in our head, and that's our touchstone because we were never into sports.
And he's so sincere when he talks about them and how much affection he has for movies. There's nobody on The Player that's like that. Do you know what I mean? There's no one who has genuine affection for movies, really. I mean, Fred Ward comes close, but even he is kind of just reminiscing about the good old days.
And really, if there was any justice, the Gene Hackman character should love movies.
Right.
I mean, he's right. living the dream, albeit
right.
low budget.
Right.
I'm thinking there's a lot, not stylistically so much, but thematically, there's a lot in common between the player and habeas corpus in the end of the film
mm-hmm.
and the end of Get Shorty.
Yeah.
Where suddenly
right.
Another level of reality
right.
is revealed. The Cadillac, a minivan.
It's so funny. And again, my students didn't even laugh at all when everyone's driving that van at the end
of
the movie.
I was going to say,
it's such a great joke. They don't appreciate anything.
Was I so desperately not want to be cynical about your students. Was there anything in Get Shorty they liked?
Not vocally. If they like stuff, they don't let you know.
Did they recognize that was James Gandolfini before he became famous?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
After the movie, you discussed it.
Yeah.
And what did they say?
Yeah, it was good. I mean, nobody has anything to say. I don't know. It's every semester I start off with a movie about movies, and I've tried. I tried Hail Caesar. That was a disaster. I showed Matinee. I showed State and Main. Now I tried Get Shorty. Next semester I might try Bowfinger. Ed Wood, they will have no patience for.
No.
But Ed Wood is one of the best movies about movies ever made.
Yes. But in its own way, Bowfinger is also a terrific movie about movies.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. But they're not going to, I mean, who knows? We'll see. We'll see. I don't know. I would like to think of some of my favorites, but I mean, there's so many movies about movies and it gets obnoxious again, the way.
But the list that you just gave,
those
I mean,
are all
that's,
good.
That's,
yeah.
Those are all in the top 10.
Yeah. Anything else about the player?
I give Tim Robbins a lot of credit for showing his penis because I do not want to be sexist. I was raised, I feel, at a time when perhaps men were even rewarded for being sexist.
Mm-hmm.
I so desperately don't want to be sexist. I think every actor
mm-hmm.
should show their penis on film.
Interesting.
I think that should be required. And then, so screenwriters would have to start getting really clever about the way that it's done. But Tim Robbins.
I believe in Altman's next movie, Shortcuts, Huey Lewis shows his penis. So it perhaps becomes a recurring motif.
Yes, and it's very refreshing.
Altman.
In fact, in Shortcuts, he's peeing into the
he sure is.
The river, and that's,
and then there's a body.
Yeah,
that movie's so good, though.
It really is.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, thank you guys for listening. Please go to fthismovie.com. Read more about F This Movie Fest. Read more articles. Listen to more podcasts. What else? Am I
on a personal note?
Yeah.
Leave more comments.
Oh,
because I don't want to sound ungrateful. But when someone, I'm not mentioning any names, goes through the entire Blood Island box set, which is four movies that might not be the best movies to watch, and then gets one comment.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you guys very much for listening. We will be
now
back
I'm sad.
Next week. I'm very sorry. We'll be back next week. Thanks for coming, JB. Traffic was a bitch.
Thanks for listening to F This Movie.